From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Negotiations are ongoing between the Senate Judiciary Committee and attorneys for the Bay Area professor accusing Judge Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault. Christine Blasey Ford is putting conditions on her appearance before the committee. They include not having to be in the same room with Kavanaugh. We'll look at possible compromises and timelines right after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA with attendance only twice per term. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you got a good start to your Friday and you have a nice weekend planned. We're going to try and help with that. Maybe a good movie that you want to see in the next couple days. Film Week coming up at 11 o'clock. Our critics will weigh in on all the week's new movies. We'll also talk with Sharon Waxman, joining us from The Wrap. We'll be talking about the interviews she's conducted with people who've made allegations of sexual misconduct in Hollywood, what effect that's had personally on them as well as on their careers. But first, we turn our attention to Congress, where negotiations continue over sexual assault allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. As you just heard on NPR News, attorneys for accuser Christine Blasey Ford have shared the professor's conditions for testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Well, let's talk about what the back and forth entails with us, congressional reporter for Bloomberg News, Laura Litvan. Laura, good to have you with us. What's the very latest?
We are still waiting to hear if, after last night's conversation between Ford's attorneys and Democratic and Republican staff, whether something will emerge, whether they will be able to agree on the terms of a hearing next week. Chuck Grassley, the committee chairman, indicated last night he did acknowledge that this meeting had taken place and said he was going to be talking to the Republicans on the committee about what she's requesting, which is a Thursday hearing rather than a Monday hearing that was established by Grassley earlier. She wants other witnesses to testify, including Mark Judge, which is, of course, a friend of Brett Kavanaugh's, who Ford said was present during the alleged sexual assault in the early 1980s. And she does not want a setup for this that is like a trial, which Republicans have been looking at doing with outside counsel questioning both her and Kavanaugh. She would prefer that the senators themselves ask questions.
Well, and that would benefit Democrats, of course. How closely are her attorneys believed to be working with Democrats in the Senate? Because setting aside which might be a more comfortable position for her, there's certainly a bigger political benefit for Democrats if Republicans are in the awkward position of essentially cross-examining her.
No one has actually acknowledged that those types of conversations are taking place. It would not surprise me that they are. They do want a lot of the same things, or may just be operating with the understanding that there are certain, you know, aspects of this that they would like to see in terms of the way this plays out. The Democrats, of course, want a chance to question Kavanaugh again about this and to be able to ask the types of questions that they want to afford. And, you know, this, we really don't know that they will be able to agree to the terms. We think that because the Republicans have opened the door, that they're kind of in a political situation where they probably can't walk away from this.
One of the supposed terms that had come out was that she wanted to go after Kavanaugh was questioned. And then, you know, we've heard from some members of the Judiciary Committee, Republicans who've talked to different media outlets, that they would not entertain that idea. Have you been able to glean whether that's something on which the Judiciary Committee might agree to her terms?
I don't have any information that suggests they would. In fact, I also am hearing that the Republicans would prefer that she go first, and she is making the allegations, and then that Judge Kavanaugh then be the next witness to testify.
We're talking with congressional reporter for Bloomberg News, Laura Litvan, with us to talk about the very latest in the accusations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh by Palo Alto College professor Christine Blasey Ford. So it sounds like all of these different potential conditions of her testifying before the committee are up in the air. What's the timeline backdrop as the Republicans on the committee are trying to push to get a vote?
Well, the Republicans in the Senate really want to get Kavanaugh confirmed by the start of the new Supreme Court term, which is October 1st. And they had been on track to have a vote just this last Thursday and, of course, had to delay this after these allegations emerged. And in recent days, they really had set a bit of a deadline for Ford, of course, saying that they set a hearing date for Monday. They needed to know by 10 a.m. Friday morning today that she had prepared testimony that she would get to them in a biography. And, of course, that has slipped as these talks are going on. But they want to have a vote next week if they can. And Mitch McConnell, just this morning, the Senate Majority Leader, was assuring a crowd of conservatives at a Washington event, a values voter convention, that Kavanaugh would be on the court very soon. And he said, you know, in the very near future, Judge Kavanaugh will be on the Supreme Court. And then he told them, keep the faith. Don't get rattled by any of this. So that determination remains very much in place.
Laura, I also wonder about President Trump's tweets this morning in which he went after the accusations that were made and questioning why there wasn't a police report at the time that the alleged incident took place. We just heard on NPR News some of the details of that. You know, previously, we'd been hearing people close to the president were kind of shocked and happy that he hadn't weighed in on this, hadn't attacked the professor. Now he's done so. And have you been able to find out what the response is from Republicans since he did that earlier today?
We have reached out to a number of Republican lawmakers on the Judiciary Committee and leadership. We've reached out to Republican Senators Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins and Jeff Flake, who are all pivotal in this confirmation. They are the ones who are kind of swing votes in this. And none of these senators, no Republican senator that we've reached out to has responded yet. The Democrats are responding. Chuck Schumer, the minority leader, tweeted just a little bit ago, and he said it's a highly offensive misunderstanding of surviving trauma because, of course, Trump was suggesting that there should have been charges filed years ago. So Schumer called it, you know, highly offensive. And then he said thousands and thousands of strong women have kept being assaulted to themselves for a variety of understandable reasons. The president doesn't even try to understand trauma survivors. He'd rather use their pain for political purposes. Now, the politics of all this, you know, underpin everything. Republicans are just under intense pressure to consider the allegations in a way that doesn't turn women and independents away from the party, you know, while they're trying to move this nomination forward as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and Democrats, of course, wanting to run the clock as much as they can. So you got the competing political agendas of the parties that are at play here. Thank you so much for being with us, Laura. We really appreciate your sharing the latest from Capitol Hill.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Laura Litvan is congressional reporter for Bloomberg News. Also joining us, Republican political analyst Sean T. Walsh, who's one of our regulars on our Monday political roundup. Sean, thank you for joining us. I want to ask you first about the president's tweet. This seems to me to be so counterproductive. I mean, setting aside the emotional impact of saying this about someone who's accused who is making a serious sexual assault claim. Just looking at the politics of this, what would lead him to think this is a good idea?
Well, Larry, you're spot on. Although one would say what would lead him to think and then fill in the blank was a good idea to tweet out on any number of 100 or 1,000 other matters. I will tell you from a Republican perspective and my discussions with folks back in Washington and other states, they think the Republicans have actually handled this in just the right way. They put up through Grassley, who's a gentleman and a very respectable individual, seven different ways that this person who's making these allegations can come and testify: public, private, written. you know, outside counsel do it. All of those things, putting an opportunity for her to be heard. They had not heard from her side really directly. They had seen her lawyers go on TV, but were not communicating with their staff until, I think, yesterday. Now they've put down terms that they will lay out. I have to tell you, it's really something to have someone dictate terms to the United States Senate about what they will or will not do, whether they're going to come forward for this body or not, when they're going to put an issue forward. So I think the Republicans were feeling very good about how they've comported themselves now, and this tweet kind of puts it back into the muddied water of, you know, politics and insensitivity.
But Sean, why wouldn't her representatives try and make the environment for her to provide the testimony in a way that is most comfortable for her? I mean, they may end up with some sort of a compromise here, but wouldn't it seem reasonable to you that they would try and come up with an environment for her that is as least stressful in a very stressful circumstance as this as possible?
Absolutely, but they should do it through communication with Senator Grassley directly or his staff, his or her staff, and not through CNN and MSNBC and Rachel Maddow. So were I to try and figure out the best way to have it, my concerns heard, I would do that through the committee. Or, you know, if they don't feel comfortable, have Dianne Feinstein speak directly to her and have her talk to Mr. Grassley and handle it that way.
Well, she made it clear in that Washington Post report last weekend, that article, she doesn't want to see Kavanaugh confirmed. She doesn't think that he is morally fit to be a Supreme Court justice. So, again, wouldn't it make sense that her representatives would be working the political angle of this as well, her attorneys, because, you know, in addition to wanting to tell her story, she wants to stop this nomination. She doesn't believe he's fit. So is it unreasonable for them to be pulling out all the stops to try and stop Kavanaugh?
Well, then you answered your own question, Larry, which is basically this is a political drill. Every member of the Democratic caucus on the Senate Judiciary Committee has not wanted to see him confirmed. Most Democrats in the country, particularly the activist side, do not want to see him confirmed. There's enormous pressure from the Bernie Sanders and the pink hat crowd to really put pressure on Democrats. And there's a reason why the Democrats want to see this hearing delayed past the November election, because it takes pressure off people like Jones in Alabama and Heitkamp and folks all over the country. So if they have to vote and they're seen in this political environment, that hurts them. So the longer they delay and the more they make Republicans look insensitive to women, the better they think they will do in the midterm election. So I think you're spot on. I think it's a whole political drill. If she has concerns and if she was assaulted, and I have no reason to believe her one way or the other, she should go up, she should make her case, and then once she's made her case, then Mr. Kavanaugh should respond to that case. I think that's the way to do it, and hopefully we get Thursday. But I will tell you, if I were Senator Grassley, I would give the Thursday date, but I'd say no more. You're going to come in here, we'll either do it in open session or closed session, but you're going to say what you're going to say, and then Mr. Kavanaugh is going to respond to what comes from that. And if there's any necessity to do anything else beyond that, so be it.
All right. And just clarify, Sean, I'm not saying it's all political on her part. I'm just saying that is part of this because she wants to stop his nomination. She believes he's morally unfit. Let me bring into the conversation Occidental College Associate Professor of Politics, Caroline Heldman. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Good to be with you.
First of all, your thoughts on do you think that there is a reasonable compromise that both parties could come to for Professor Blasey Ford's testimony?
I think there's an eminently reasonable compromise and that both parties are working toward that. I'm still confused as to why the FBI isn't able to conduct an investigation, given the gravity of the claims. You would want the professionals actually doing the digging and determining who is telling the truth and who is not. So it is surprising to me that Kavanaugh has not called for an FBI investigation, if indeed he is innocent. And I would just, I guess, add to the conversation that's already taken place by saying that according to the FBI's stats, overall, 2 to 8% of rape allegations are unsupported, which means that there is a very high likelihood that someone who comes forward is telling the truth. And so given that, I would like to see a process that actually makes sense rather than simply having a Senate committee bring in outsiders in order to interrogate. This is something that the professionals need to handle, and I'm not really sure why that's not happening, except for politics.
Just a couple things to say about the 2-8% statistic. We should mention that's of reported cases to law enforcement, so that is a subset of sexual assault. Secondly, my understanding of the statistic is those are the cases that can be demonstrably proven as false. It doesn't put a percentage as the cases where it's indeterminate because it's one person's word against another. So it is likely a higher percentage once you factor in those other factors. But the fact is, we don't know at this point.
Larry, that is the two to 8% is the indiscriminate. That's you cannot prove. It's not patently false or cases that where there is evidence. Those are cases where there is not external evidence or other corroborating evidence which would support the claim.
All right. I'll have to take a look at that study then. I'm sorry I've missed that. And these are of reported cases, obviously. That's how the FBI would have knowledge of them. The other issue is my understanding that even though Kavanaugh could request the FBI open his background check or you could have Grassley do that, it has to be President Trump because it wouldn't be a criminal investigation. There's no allegation of a federal violation of the law here. So it would have to be a reopening of the background check, and the president hasn't given any indication he's willing to do that. So if you were in Grassley's position, what would you do if the president's not going to call for that?
Well, I would do exactly what Grassley is doing and give Dr. Ford her day in court. I can understand her reluctance, given what happened to Anita Hill in 1991, and given the fact that, you know, even when Democrats were running the show in 1991, up against a person who, you know, Clarence Thomas, who was a Republican or conservative nominee, Joe Biden overseeing that process still didn't let two other women testify to support an additional claim. And since that time, since Anita Hill's testimony, Moira Smith came forth in 1999 and said that Clarence Thomas groped her at an event. So I think that watching the railroading of Anita Hill in 1991 is likely what is driving Dr. Ford to be very reluctant and very careful and planful about how she comes forward today.
We're talking with Caroline Heldman, Associate Professor of Politics, Occidental College in Eagle Rock, Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst. And coming up, we're going to talk about the legal aspects of this. How should the testimony be conducted if it actually comes together? Should it be conducted like a court hearing? Should it bear similarities or significant differences from the aforementioned Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill hearing? Should it be done like a Title IX, like you'd have in an academic setting? We'll continue our conversation in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Film Week coming up in our second hour. Got a lot of movies out this week. We'll talk about those and also talk about what the response has been for those who have made accusations in Hollywood as a part of the Me Too movement. How has that affected the careers of those that are accused? We know that the careers of many people who've had accusations against them have been dramatically changed. But what about those who've made the accusations? We'll hear about that coming up on Film Week as well next hour here on 89.3 KPECC. Right now, our focus is on whether there will be a hearing next week in which the accuser of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh lays out her allegations that Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her more than three decades ago. The attorneys for Christine Blasey Ford are reportedly in negotiations with the Senate Judiciary Committee's Republicans. With us to talk about the legal aspects of this, Laura Bazelon, USF School of Law professor. She was a trial attorney here in Los Angeles in the Public Defender's Office for 7 years and has litigated a number of Title IX cases. Professor Bazelon, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, what do you think would be the best sort of a format to attempt to get closer to the truth here?
Well, there are two ends of the spectrum when we look at proceedings like this. On the one end of the spectrum is something like a criminal trial. And I think that that's the kind of situation that we would want to avoid. And it's something that Dr. Ford and her attorneys want to avoid, meaning that she would basically be in the same room with Judge Kavanaugh and have to give her testimony while having to look at him, which would be extremely difficult. Now, if this were a criminal trial, she wouldn't have a choice because the Sixth Amendment provides the accused with the right to confront and cross-examine witnesses. But this isn't a criminal trial. To me, it's more analogous to Title IX proceedings in which there are protections in place for the accuser in most schools. I should say that it varies from university to university, but generally speaking, the person who is making the accusation and the person who is facing the accusation testify separately in front of a panel.
Now, the academic environment is a little bit different, right, because the schools have a legal responsibility to create a safe environment for students, faculty, and staff. And so these proceedings are how should I put this? It's not about just guilt or innocence like a criminal trial. It's about the overall safety of the environment, if I make sense. I mean, you're the expert. I don't mean to be usurping you on this. But how does this relate to that notion of safety of the environment?
You're right that there are key differences in these proceedings, and this Senate proceeding has very little precedent, and what precedent we have, which are the Anita Hill hearings, is pretty awful precedent that I don't think anybody wants to repeat. But going back to your question about the safety of the person bringing the accusation, I think the overall goal here is to get to the truth as best we can, and the way to do that is to set conditions for testimony for both sides where both sides feel that they are as comfortable as possible, given the Klieg lights that are on them and given the stakes, being as calm and collected as they can be and being in an environment where they feel that they are being respected. And I think when you say to someone who has brought forth an allegation as serious as Dr. Ford's, what we expect you to do essentially is testify as a witness in a criminal trial and have to face Judge Kavanaugh, and have all of these other procedures in place that we would normally see in a criminal trial, that doesn't seem to me to make a whole lot of sense in this situation.
Now, she's going to have attorneys, of course, if this happens. She would have attorneys who would be assisting her through the process. Would Judge Kavanaugh have counsel that would be there alongside him during the time when he testifies?
I would think so, and I would think that it would be appropriate for both of them to have access to their lawyers. As you know, Judge Kavanaugh had access to counsel throughout the rest of his confirmation proceedings, and I don't see why it would be different now. And at the same time, I don't see why Dr. Ford should be deprived of the opportunity to consult with her lawyers during her testimony.
And do you think it would make more sense to have professional counsel who would be directing the questions or to have the senators on the committee themselves ask the questions?
I don't think that outsourcing this to an outside attorney is a good idea. I think the Republicans are in a virtually impossible situation because there are 11 white men, Republicans, on the Judiciary Committee, and that's an immutable fact that they can't change. What they also can't change is the specter of the Anita Hill hearings and how some of them behaved back then. So it's not surprising to me that they want to outsource this, but it would be a mistake. First of all, I think what probably would happen is that they would try to hire a female attorney, and I actually think it would backfire because it would be seen as a very cynical ploy. But I also think that that's not how this should go. That's not how these hearings traditionally proceed. It would be a gross departure. It's not what Dr. Ford wants, and it doesn't afford Democrats or Republicans the chance to ask their own questions. So to me, it seems like a mistake to go that route, and I am not surprised that Dr. Ford and her lawyers do not want that.
But if the concern is that the senators, because they're white and male, would be insensitive, wouldn't this be an opportunity for someone who Professor Ford believes might be more sensitive would be asking the questions?
Well, I think it's really a burden on the senators, and particularly Chuck Grassley and Orrin Hatch and Lindsey Graham, who have come out publicly and said a number of what I think are unfortunate things about Dr. Ford, to conduct themselves appropriately and to control themselves and ask questions that are probing but in an appropriate and respectful manner. Outsourcing it seems to be relieving themselves of what I think of as a completely normal and responsible obligation.
We're talking with University of San Francisco School of Law professor Laura Bazelon joining us. She litigated Title IX cases and served as a public defender in the federal public defender office here in Los Angeles. Also joining us, attorney who specializes in Title IX cases based in Los Angeles, Jenna Parker. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning, Larry.
How do you think this ideally would be formatted if the hearing comes together?
You know, typically in administrative processes, which is what I'm kind of used to dealing with, they're pretty informal, but they include elements of due process. And I think the most simple elements of due process are notice and an opportunity to be heard. So that would have to be included here. We'd have to know, you know, what exactly the allegations are, what, you know, what evidence of those allegations are do we have. There has to be a right to question, to challenge the credibility. There, you know, of course, we should believe the victim and allow her to tell her story, but there also has to be a presumption of innocence in this case.
Well, and how do you have both? If you believe her coming out of the gate and yet you presume innocence on his part, those sound contradictory.
Yeah, they definitely are. And that's kind of the difficulty of these processes. And that's why, you know, there has to be an opportunity for, I think, Ford to tell her story and to share everything. But if she, you know, can't prove her claims, then, you know, he shouldn't be found responsible.
And how do you think, let's say senators are the ones who do that questioning, and so you would have Democrats who would be attempting to bolster her story, you would have Republicans who would be attempting to find cracks or a lack of information that might somehow undermine the story that she is conveying. So how do you, if you were advising the senators, how should they navigate this?
You know, that's I think a really hard question to answer, and I think that's something that even in informal student procedures, courts are having a difficult time answering. How do you respect the, you know, accusers and protect her, and then how do you also give, you know, respect due process? I think, you know, in the student proceedings, what's happening a lot of times is that, you know, your attorney or Brett Kavanaugh's attorney or, you know, he himself would be allowed to, you know, draft questions so that he could get to the bottom of what she is alleging. And then those questions would be asked of Ford either, you know, indirectly or directly in some manner.
And there's a separate issue here beyond his nomination hanging in the balance. There is also his professional representation, reputation, even though this isn't a criminal proceeding. What rights does Judge Kavanaugh have, you know, beyond what the senators are asking to defend himself in this? Is it just on him to, you know, essentially try and tell a more compelling story than what she says?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of what I was getting at with the presumption of innocence. It's so hard in these cases because with believing, you know, the victim, that presumption is just lost automatically, which is devastating to people, especially to Judge Kavanaugh, who his entire life has, you know, worked very hard to get to where he is and to be respected and to have the reputation that he has. I think in these proceedings, it's a little bit unusual that Ford, you know, wants to testify first. It kind of shifts that burden so that Kavanaugh does have to prove his innocence rather than Ford having to prove her claims.
So you mean in having Kavanaugh go first as they requested?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And it sounds like the committee is not going to go for that. What would be the challenge to Kavanaugh if he went first?
The challenge to Kavanaugh if he went? I mean, I don't think there would be a challenge to Kavanaugh. I think Kavanaugh.
Well, I mean, wouldn't he be trying to defend himself against only what was in the Washington Post story?
Exactly, yes, yeah. The challenge to Kavanaugh going first is that he doesn't know exactly what Ford is saying. He doesn't know what her full allegations are. It seems like it's a way for Ford to then, you know, take what Kavanaugh is saying and to develop her story around that.
Let me go back to Laura Bazelon, University of San Francisco School of Law. What do you think, just as you're watching this whole thing, what do you think is the most likely outcome we're going to see?
Well,
I can tell you the outcome I would like to see, and I do agree with Ms. Parker that I do believe that it should go in the normal order of these kinds of cases, which is that Dr. Ford bringing the accusation should go first and Judge Kavanaugh should go second. But I also think that what should happen is they should subpoena Mark Judge, who was an eyewitness to what happened. It's unusual often in these assault cases to have an eyewitness, and we do have one, a person who has publicly made some statements that are arguably contradictory and then has said he's going to refuse to cooperate. And it seems to me that given that Senator Grassley has subpoena power, he should be called before the committee and have to answer questions too. So that's how I would see the whole thing proceeding ideally. The reality is that I doubt that will happen. And I think what we're likely to see is a proceeding in which there are two witnesses, Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh, and it's going to boil down to who the senators find more believable, filtered through the prism of their own respective political agenda.
Well, and if you were the attorney for Mark Judge and he was subpoenaed to testify and he's already admitted that he had serious drinking problems when he was younger and potentially that could have affected his memory, would you allow him to answer questions?
Well, it doesn't seem to me that confessing to something under oath that he's already written about in a published book, which is that he had a drinking problem, is going to expose him to some kind of criminal liability. If that were true, probably a lot of the state of California would be locked up right now. So I don't see, barring something that we don't know already, him having any criminal exposure. And what I do see is that he's an eyewitness with potentially very powerful testimony and the ability to speak to the larger culture in which this alleged assault took place.
I want to thank you for being with us, Laura Bazelon, University of San Francisco School of Law professor, Jenna Parker, attorney with the firm Worksman Jackson Hathaway and Quinn, based in Los Angeles. She specializes in Title IX cases. You can share your comments about what you would hope to see coming out of a potential hearing. Of course, if it happens next week, we'll carry it for you live right here on 89.3 KPCC. But of course, it's an if as they continue with their negotiations. Much more to come after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Film Week is coming up shortly. Got a lot of movies that are out this week, including The House with a Clock in Its Walls. It's a fantasy comedy from director Eli Roth. Yeah, the guy behind those torture porn films doing a fantasy comedy rated PG. That's right. So we'll hear about that coming up here on Film Week in just a few minutes. But first, we turn our attention to all the apps that are out there to help preschoolers learn. So many parents rely on these, on their tablets, even their phones, to help their kids get a head start when it comes to literacy and math. But the question is, do these apps really educationally benefit kids or just occupy their time? UC Irvine School of Education undertook a study on this, and we're glad to have with us the co-author of the study, Associate Professor of Education at UCI, Stephanie Reich. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Share with us the various apps that you studied. What did you find?
Sure. So I don't know if people are aware, but about half of the educational app market is targeted to young children. And we were really curious. You know, we have decades of research about what helps children learn and the best ways to teach them. And we were really focused on how much we would see those principles designed into apps.
And so looking at these, what, first of all, did you get a sense of how heavily researched they were to see if they used some of the proven methods for teaching literacy and math?
Well, so we created a list of things that we would think we would see, and then we selected the top 10 free and premium apps from Apple and Android for 3 months for literacy and for math. And so then we coded. It's quite fun. We got to play a lot of apps for preschoolers to look at how prevalent we saw these kinds of behaviors or design features we would expect to see if they're going to truly be educational for young children.
And were you able to actually test kids to see what have they learned, or is that just not possible with preschoolers because there's not a way for them necessarily to convey what they're learning from the app directly?
Well, it's a separate process. So we really wanted to look at the content of these apps. We have decades of research about how children learn, and we wanted to see how much design is really using those factors. We have a series of other studies in which we actually design apps manipulating those components of them to see how beneficial they are for learning. But this study that just came out is really a content analysis of the apps themselves.
And you found that the content really doesn't match the research that shows what works?
Not great. Some things were good, like apps for preschoolers tend to be very simple. They tend to use a lot of auditory written and spoken instructions rather than relying on words that kids have to read when they're not very literate at this age. But lots of things that we know help kids learn. One is an idea of scaffolding, just like you scaffold a building, that if you're trying to learn something that's new or hard, you get a lot of supports early on and then those lessen. And in game design, that happens with feedback that explains why you're right or wrong, so you could really focus on what you need to know to be able to be successful. It also means modifying the complexity. So if you finish one round, it gets harder as you go, or if you are not doing well, it gets easier and it adapts to how you perform. And both of those types of scaffolding are exceedingly rare in app design.
We're talking with UC Irvine Associate Professor of Education, co-author of the new study looking at apps that are designed for kids under the age of five. Stephanie Reich with us. We're at 866-893-KPECC. If you're a parent and you either have a little one now or you did have a preschooler and you use some of these apps, what did you like? What did you not like? Were there particular ones you felt really benefited your son or daughter? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. As we just heard from Professor Reich, these are very popular apps. Parents like to expose their kids to them, believe at least that there's a benefit in their kids being exposed to these educational apps. So if you're a parent who is using one or more or have used one of these apps, I'd like to hear what your experience is, what you felt the benefits, any limitations, or maybe you have a cautionary tale, app gone wrong. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I certainly understand, Professor, the notion of scaffolding to help children or adults, for that matter, master difficult material. But I wonder, in the case of preschoolers, is there not some educational benefit in just exposing kids to a wide array of stuff, to images, to ideas, to as opposed to the formalized learning that scaffolding is designed to deliver and measure?
Well, I think exploration is fun. These games have right or wrong kinds of play. They're supposed to be teaching. And I think just hearing, nope, try again, good try, is not educational. It's not giving them anything to work with versus if you're looking for a certain shape, saying a triangle has 3 points, you know, and giving you some guidance to be able to identify those kinds of shapes or numbers. I think that they're marketed as educational apps, and if parents are buying them for that purpose, it would be nice to know they're designed in a way that helps children learn.
Also, we understand that people read differently, that our brains work somewhat differently when we read off of a screen versus when we read a hard copy of something. Do you have any concerns about the use of a tablet or a phone to deliver something like this educationally versus something in book form?
I don't have concerns myself. We have been studying this. We just finished a different study where we ran 200 preschoolers having a book read to them as an ebook or having a person read to them. And we actually didn't find very many differences. That for kids, being read to is useful. Having language exposure is useful, and screens help with that. For e-reading in young children, there's actually a very robust literature about the components that make them educational for kids and the ways in which technology can facilitate reading more or can really distract. If you have books with lots of hot spots where you can tap stuff and get off task, it's much harder to learn in those capacities when they're so busy. Young kids get overwhelmed by cognitive information faster than adults. They have less capacity for it. And so in those ways, I think well-designed ebooks are really fantastic. And some people learn in different ways, and a variety of modalities of print, of spoken word, of screen reading can all be beneficial.
We'll take calls from parents coming up next. Like to hear from you what you think about various educational apps you are using or have used for your preschooler. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We're talking about a new study out of UC Irvine, the School of Education there. Stephanie Reich, Associate Professor of Education, is co-author of this study, which calls into question the educational approach taken by many of these popular preschool-directed apps. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. And again, we remind you, Film Week coming up at 11 o'clock today. We'll hear a review of Michael Moore's new documentary, Fahrenheit 11/9. Back in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about the pros and cons of educational apps designed for preschoolers. New study out of UC Irvine questions some of the methodology that those apps employ. Ryan in Lake Forest, what's your experience been with your daughter with this?
Well, whenever my daughter came started utilizing the pad, we had her using shape and matching apps that she really enjoyed, but the ones that had her trying to read the story, she wasn't reading it, and she was always having it read to her, and she wasn't communicating very much to us. She wasn't talking as much as we were expecting. And now she's four, and we stopped her using the apps about 8 months ago, and we've gone to matching games and playing Candyland with her and reading books to her. And now she's reading ahead of the curve, and we feel that she's talking every day more and more, and we think that it's directly because we took the apps out of her hand and put the responsibility of the teacher in our hands, and we've just seen a tremendous improvement. So, I mean, we're going to definitely steer our second child away from the apps entirely.
And, of course, you know, it may be difficult to determine how much of it is substituting yourselves for the apps versus just, you know, that she's getting older. But you feel very directly about shifting the way you expose her to this material.
Yes, because she just got to the point where when we would take it away from her, she would cry profusely, and then she'd wake up in the morning and she'd be going right for the iPad and learn to crack. We put a code on it, and she learned how to get in on her own. So
wow,
she can navigate around an iPad like crazy.
Yeah, kids are very gifted that way. Professor Reich, your response to Ryan.
Well, I would agree that having more language exposure is great for kids, and especially if your daughter was having a lot of time on the tablet and not as interactive with people, then that's less language exposure. There is research that as kids are much younger, they don't get as much language from screens, and as she gets older, it might have had more benefit, but unequivocally, even if your child is using a tablet, talking with her about what's happening on that tablet and exposing her to other language and other ways to process that information would be beneficial.
Ryan, appreciate your call. Thanks for your experience. Lines open. Like to hear from you. If you're a parent, you've used educational apps on tablet or phone for your child, 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Professor, how did you decide on the apps that you chose? Was this based on the number of downloads the app had had, or sales of it? How did you determine that they were influential?
Yeah, so we picked the top 10 on the ratings. You know, when you go on to the
ratings, okay,
Apple Store or Google Play or Amazon, it's top 10 within those categories, and we just select the top 10 every month.
All right. And is there a way of generalizing which parts you think they did a better job on than others?
Yeah, so I think they're visually appealing. I think they are clear in what the task is pretty easily, and they are designed in a way that little fingers can move things pretty well. Unfortunately, very few of the apps we looked at use other features of tablets, like being able to tilt things or take pictures or find other ways to learn and explore with a tablet. They didn't really capitalize on the affordances of it. That most of them provided some kind of reward system, often just stickers. And so some kind of reward is useful, but it's much better if that reward were tied to educational goals, that you unlock some other level or some additional skill that helps you learn versus the reward being very separate from the task.
Are these apps typically free or paid apps?
So the ones we coded were half free and half premium paid for. But there were very few differences whether they were free or paid for.
And what are the ways that you mentioned the need to scaffold the content so you build on methods? This wouldn't seem hard for tablets to do because you accomplish something, you would move on to the next level. Why do you think that that's not being utilized more frequently, that approach?
My best guess is that app designers are not developmental scientists. I think that our fields have not communicated as well as they should. Academics make apps, and they tend to be not very pretty, and they're kind of boring. And game designers make apps that tend to be really interesting and pretty and not as educational. I think there needs to be more connection between the fields.
Ellie in San Pedro, what's your experience with your child?
We use this app, Title Maker, Object Maker, and you put the iPad screen in front of a chair, and it would say chair, refrigerator, things like that. It for about 2 months with my four-year-old, and she didn't pick up on anything. It just was. She thought it was some other type of game. So then the grandmother, my mother, came into the picture, and she said, "No, this is what I did for you. And by kindergarten, you were two grades above everybody. You make handmade labels, and you tape them to the object." Our whole apartment has labels on everything, the chair, the dog, you know, everything. And she's speaking out. She says the words. She makes little songs out of it. I'm sitting in the chair. I'm sitting in the chair. She never did that with the app.
That's really cute. A lot of work for you and your mom, but glad that it has borne results like that. Ellie, thanks so much. The Post-it approach. Professor Reich?
Well, there is some research on this transfer deficit, the ability to learn something on a screen and whether you transfer it over. And actually, there's some really exciting research from Georgetown that's been showing that the quality of a parent-child interaction facilitates transfer. So kids alone on a tablet may not take what they learn to the non-digital world, but if a parent's there and they have a high-quality interaction with them, they're more likely to transfer that.
So is this kind of the emotional power of the parent with the child that there's a tremendous value added in that because it's not just information, but there's emotional weight to it?
Emotion might be part of it. We're just inherently social creatures. We learn best by social interactions. And some of it is overt and explicit, and some of it is covert and subtle. But children are excellent at reading facial expressions. They key into what people say more than any other sounds they hear. And so it makes sense that in all capacities we learn better with others for the most part, and tablets seem to be another one of those genres.
Andrea, in Newport Coast, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, Larry. I'm a mom of an 8- and 9-year-old, two daughters, and we are completely screen-free in our house with the exception of movie night on Friday nights.
And your kids haven't complained about not having any tablets or screens in the house?
You know, they don't know what they don't know. It's been our culture from the beginning. So for them, that's not even an option. If they're bored, it's going outside or playing a board game or playing with their toys. For them, that's not an issue.
Yeah. And you feel like you've lost out on anything with your kids in that?
No way. In fact, their teachers have confidentially told me that they can see a big difference between the kids that have a lot of screen time at home versus kids who go to books or toys or, you know, actual game playing.
Andrea, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. My thanks to UC Irvine, Associate Professor of Education, Stephanie Reich, co-author of the study looking at the top 10 apps, both free and premium apps that are used by parents with their preschoolers, finding that in most cases, those apps were really not developed using sound educational principles. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Film Week is coming up very shortly here on 89.3. I want to take this weekly opportunity to thank our extraordinary team on AirTalk. They are the best, led by senior producer Fiona Ng. Our thanks to our great producer team of Natalie Chudnovsky, Matt D'Angelo-Antonio, Carol Galli. Caitlin Plummer also helped us this week. And our news apprentices are Itzy Quintanilla and Matt Bynum. And our terrific technical director, Ethan Service, making sure everything's running well in the studio. Film Week coming up. We'll tell you about all the movies in just a moment.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth. Offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start January 7th. Apply by October 1st to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. I'm joined this week by critics Justin Chang of the Los Angeles Times and Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian and host of the podcast The Canon and Unspooled. We begin with A House with a Clock in Its Walls, directed by Eli Roth, known for a very different kind of film, written by Eric Kripke. The film stars Owen Vaccaro, Jack Black, and Kate Blanchett, based on the novel by John Bellairs, about 10-year-old Lewis, who's played by Vaccaro. A young Lewis goes to live with his uncle in a creaky old house that contains a mysterious TikTok.
Hello. You're Lewis, I presume. How was your trip?
This old hag is my next-door neighbor, Mrs. Florence Zimmerman.
I'm relieved to see you didn't inherit your uncle's freakishly oversized head.
Huh. Says the woman who literally looks like a Q-tip.
Oh, look. The giant head is angry.
The film The House with a Clock in Its Walls is rated PG. Justin, what did you think?
Yeah, this is the first PG-rated film ever directed by Eli Roth, who's not a name you would associate with family-friendly entertainment. He's the director of Cabin Fever, the Hostel movies, and this year's recent terrible remake of Death Wish. So it's refreshing to see him take his natural talent for scaring and spooking the viewer and channeling that into a story for children and young adults. This isn't a great movie, but it's a charming one, and I think it does represent a step in the right direction for him. As the clip showed us, you know, a young boy named Lewis who goes and lives with his eccentric uncle and, to a large extent, the equally eccentric neighbor played by Kate Blanchett, who is always on the premises. And just the presence of these two actors, Jack Black and Kate Blanchett, is enough to elevate the material, or at least your expectations, because you know that they are going to bring professionalism and sparkling wit and comic timing and crisp delivery to it. And so it boosts the movie's confidence and your confidence as well. But the real star of this movie is in some ways The House, which is a wonderful piece of production design by John Huttman. It features, you know, these stained glass windows that are like the paintings in the Harry Potter movies that move of their own accord. There are clocks covering every wall. There are armchairs that come to life. There are lawn statues that defecate dried leaves all over the place. There's some kind of, it's like PG-rated, very mild, gross-out humor. It's a haunted house movie, but the spirit of this movie is less one of terror than of sort of genial, infectious mischief. It's a story about wizards, warlocks, witches. Kyle MacLachlan turns up as an old warlock in a wonderful bit of post-Twin Peaks casting. If you've seen Twin Peaks, it'll give you an extra smile.
Funny.
It doesn't all work, but it's diverting and there's a lot of charm to it.
And it, generally all ages, PG ratings, you would agree as a parent?
I would agree. I think PG-13 might have been pushing it. There are moments when, for example, there's this scene where these library books come flying off the shelves of their own accord and start attacking the boy played by Owen Vaccaro. And it's just a little bit bloodier than you might have expected in a pure PG, at least. That is me. Maybe having a child has sensitized me to that. So maybe it actually is not that bad. But I think Eli Roth pushes the envelope just a little bit, as he's wont to do.
Nothing like being a parent to sensitize you to this stuff, right,
no,
Justin?
Sure. Very, very
you look at it very, very differently. The House with a Clock in Its Walls, Owen Vaccaro, Jack Black, Kate Blanchett star, Eli Roth directing. It's rated PG, and it's in wide release. The Sisters Brothers, a Western comedy, stars John C. Reilly, Joaquin Phoenix, Jake Gyllenhaal, and Riz Ahmed. Jacques Audiard is the director and co-writer of the screenplay. So the film takes us back to 1850s Oregon, tells the story of a gold prospector chased by an infamous duo of assassins.
You know what happened last night? You remember that you hit me?
That's right, I slap you. You slap me back. Raven. So go ahead. Hit me. Hit me. What is your damn problem?
The Sisters Brothers, Amy?
Yeah, people might not immediately associate the name Jacques Audiard with Western comedy. I mean, he's the director who, if you're an art house fan, you definitely know him for A Prophet or Rust and Bone a few years ago. And here he is in the Wild West making this film that's at once just this beautiful, gorgeously shot, epic-looking classic Western that also has this kind of pointed look at a really raw America with these two brothers who are played by Joaquin Phoenix and John C. Reilly. Joaquin Phoenix is the younger of the two, but also the bossier, the crazier, the more violent. John C. Reilly is the sweet man who's maybe in love with a teacher. And they've both been hired by this man named the Commodore to track down this man played by Riz Ahmed, who has like a secret that they're sort of being lied to about. And so it's this chase movie where Riz Ahmed is also being chased by Jake Gyllenhaal. If people liked their pairing in Nightcrawler, I think that's sort of the fun of having them here again as these friends in the West. So, but it's really just this movie about two groups of men trying to find something to bond each other to anything. Like, it's such a raw look at what America was in this time. Whenever the camera pans around, you see, like, towns being built and towns getting their names changed. And nobody seems permanent and everybody's lying about who they are. And you get this sense of a place where nothing is really for real, for real. And I just thought it was terrifically fun. It, like, that the changeability of it almost makes it feel much more philosophical than I think people are expecting.
Yeah, I love this movie, too, for all those reasons. And also, it's just the emotional sincerity of it. This is kind of being billed as a comedy, a comic Western. But the humor, I think, always wells up from something that feels real. These men are genuinely soul-searching, even maybe to a maybe Charlie, the Charlie sisters, the brothers are the sisters' brothers because their names are Eli sisters and Charlie sisters. And Charlie is the one played by Joaquin Phoenix. He's the more volatile one. But John C. Reilly, as the older brother, Eli, who's looking out for his younger brother, is so, I mean, John C. Reilly is always good. He doesn't get enough leading roles. His soulfulness in this movie and just the humor that is almost inextricable from that soulfulness. And even though they are the top-billed pair, Riz Ahmed and Jake Gyllenhaal kind of steal the show in a lot of ways. Just I could watch a movie that was just those two hanging out and talking about, you know, what they want to do, how they want to prospect their hopes and dreams. It isn't a huge stretch for Jacques Audiard, who is a master of genre in films like A Prophet and Rust and Bone and The Beat That My Heart Skipped. And there's also, in the background of all this, is the long-running, I think, French love affair with Western culture, the mythology and the culture of the American West. It all feeds into that. And yet what's remarkable is that he's made this movie that doesn't feel, you know, revisionist. It doesn't feel like a joke on the genre. It's not like he's spoofing the genre. He's having fun with it, but he also is giving it this tremendously sincere emotional core.
Yeah, it has the shot I've always wanted to see in a Western movie where two cowboys, after riding through mountain ranges and forests, suddenly appear and get to look at the Pacific Ocean. Yeah. And, you know, every time I drive gorgeous, up the 101, yeah. I always think, like, what must that have been like? Yeah. And I love that he just shows it to us, and he shows it to us with that exact, like, combination you're talking about of awe and a little bit of wit.
Yeah, Steinbeck, for example, in The Grapes of Wrath, does a beautiful job as they come down to the Colorado River, you know, close to the end of that story. And it's just, it's every time I drive that stretch, I think about Steinbeck, you know, doing that. And so when you bring to mind seeing the ocean for the first time, it's wonderful that he was able to capture that on film.
The interesting thing, too, is the movie was largely shot in Spain, I believe.
Really?
Yeah, and partly in Romania as well. So,
The Sisters Brothers, a Western comedy. John C. Reilly, Joaquin Phoenix, Jake Gyllenhaal, Riz Ahmed star. Jacques Audiard is the director and co-screenwriter. It's based on the novel by Patrick DeWitt. It's rated R. You can see The Sisters Brothers at the Arclight in Hollywood. Michael Moore's new documentary is Fahrenheit 11-9. Moore, the director and writer, just Justin?
This being a Michael Moore movie, and even if you agree with a lot of things he's saying, as I certainly do, you can bet that it will be all over the place, full of half-truths and cheap shots and glued together with kind of specious musical cues and visual gags. The thing about this approach, though, is that all of this seems to kind of define our political discourse these days anyway. And so I feel like Moore's tactics are not only not that shocking anymore, they actually feel of a piece with the moment that we're in. And I think this is to the benefit of this movie, which is very, very fractured and wide-ranging. It starts off as what you would perhaps expect, a recreation of the roller coaster ride of election night 2016. The title, Fahrenheit 11/9, is of course a reference to that, to the day after, and also it's a play on Fahrenheit 9/11, Moore's 2004 film about the George W. Bush years. So he's sort of thumbing his nose at the pundits and pollsters who predicted an easy victory for Hillary Clinton and all of that. And he takes us through that roller coaster ride of emotion, and then he becomes perhaps, I don't know if uncharacteristically, but he becomes reflective and acknowledges his own history of like having once rubbed elbows with Trump and with people like Jared Kushner and Steve Bannon as well. So he's sort of subjecting himself to this autocritique. And then he shifts direction completely and goes back to his hometown of Flint, Michigan. And this is where the movie really springs to life, I think, where it becomes a piece of investigative reportage, a very angry piece of reportage about the water crisis, which sort of becomes a prism through which he views everything. And, you know, the focus on this movie is on grassroots activism, and it is inspiring that way. And I think that Moore's movies are always best when he steps aside. You know, he has the sort of the gag here where he's hosing down Governor Rick Snyder's mansion with water from the polluted Flint River, and Rick Snyder, if anything, comes off even worse in this movie than Donald Trump does, if that's even possible. But the best part is when he's actually talking to the people of Flint, or when he's talking to the teachers in West Virginia who went on strike, or when he's talking to the students of Stoneman Douglas.
Well, I think back, I don't know whether his first film, Roger and Me, that may have been his first, and what was so fascinating to me was how he blended humor with pathos in that, and with the interviews with people. And he kind of got away from doing that. It sounds like it's a little bit of a return to that. What do you think, Amy?
Yeah, when you do see him, you know, he's aged so much since then. I think being himself and being so passionate and being so angry, you know, he's trying to be at the front of whatever the conversation is. It feels like it's really taken a toll. And when you see him spray the governor's mansion with water, for example, he almost looks tired. Like, this is what I have to do now. Somebody has to do this. Who's going to pick up the torch? There's this mournful quality to the film I found very surprising. It's about everything and about nothing at the same time, because it's just about so much. I mean, the Stoneman Douglas kids have a big cameo in here. If there's anything that ties it together, I might say that it's just this idea that even the hope that he might have had when he made Roger and Me, that we lived in a democracy where capitalism wasn't that bad. It was bad, but maybe it wasn't going to kill us all. Now he's definitely in the capitalism will kill us all. And it's so anti-establishment on every margin. He goes after the Clintons. He goes after everybody. The people that he singles out for praise are the people I am interested in. Like, he spends a lot of time with this candidate for the House in West Virginia, who's a former paratrooper. His name is Richard Ojeda. He's incredibly muscular and gruff, and he's like, I want to fight for blue-collar rights. And that's what this film ultimately is about. And then Michael Moore just can't help going one more step further and saying, fight for blue-collar rights, but also we just might not even be in a democracy at all, and we might have just lost.
Well, and you know, Moore's being sued, as I understand, by his ex-wife, and there's a big financial dispute. And so I wonder how much of that comes into this too, because it sounds like a pretty stressful personal thing he's gone through.
Yeah, I really wonder about everything. I mean, this film made me feel passionate in one 30-second burst, and then utterly like we should just throw ourselves off a bridge in the next 30 seconds. The emotions here are all over the place, which I guess is what it's like to be alive in 2018, honestly. But
all over the board, and you feel this tension sort of between that cataclysmic despair and yet more doing his old shtick as usual with the mansion stunt. And also, there is one part where, you know, he shows footage of Hitler with Trump's speeches coming out, his rally speeches coming out of Hitler's mouth, which sounds to you like a very kind of tired trick, perhaps, but I think he actually substantiates it in ways that merit scrutiny.
Yeah, he really goes through the checklist of what fascism is and basically checks every box. Also, by the way, when he says that he used to know Jared Kushner, that's because Jared Kushner threw the premiere party for Sicko just 10 years ago. So that is how much things have changed for Kushner.
Fahrenheit 11/9, Michael Moore's new film. It's rated R. You can see it in wide release at theaters near you. Also up this week is Love, Gilda, a documentary that's directed by Lisa DiPolito. What'd you think, Amy?
Yeah, Gilda Radner is probably the first celebrity I ever knew as a child. I thought she was the most famous and wonderful woman in the world. And this documentary is really just a straight-up salute to her. It's a documentary about basically how much people love Gilda Radner, who really made her giant career on Saturday Night Live and then wrestled a lot with fame. I love this film a lot, especially when it went into her biographical story, how she was a chubby kid, was put on diet pills when she was 10 years old and sort of became this cheerful, manic person that she would channel into a lot of her sketches. And the film does try to look a lot at how much the spotlight put a pressure on her to be thin and to be popular and to be everything, and how she really crumples under that weight pretty early. I think what's really moving in here is when you see today's comedians Amy Poehler and Melissa McCarthy and Maya Rudolph reading parts of her diary, she really comes to life in those moments. And so if you're a Gilda person, this is just a pleasure.
We're talking about the documentary Love, Gilda. Lisa D'Apolito is the director. The film is unrated. Coming up, we'll hear about Life Itself, starring Oscar Isaac and Olivia Wilde, and Colette, a new biographical drama. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle with film critics Amy Nicholson and Justin Chang. Next up is Life Itself, starring Oscar Isaac and Olivia Wilde, written and directed by Dan Fogelman, who created the hit TV series This Is Us. Life Itself follows the relationship of a young New York couple, Abby and Will, as they move from college romance to marriage and the birth of their first child.
You ever gonna ask me out, Will?
I'm just waiting for the right moment.
I'll see you around.
Abby, I'm waiting for the right moment, because when I ask you out, there's not going to be any turning back for me.
Life Itself. Amy, what you think?
Yeah, this movie is a doozy. This is one of those ultra-fragmented, choppy, over-cerebral, kind of 90s-style wunderkind, look what a genius I am for putting this script together script. We have the segment that you did talk about, which is Oscar Wilde and his love of his life, Olivia Wilde. They meet in college.
Oscar Isaac, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, Oscar Wilde. Back from the dead. I told you, this movie is really something, guys.
It's not that well written.
Oh my gosh, Oscar Wilde, Olivia Wilde. Wow, I wonder if they're related. They're not related.
And Olivia Isaac, yes.
But Olivia Wilde is one of those like gorgeous dream girls that you see in scripts like this. She gives long, passionate monologues about how Bob Dylan is an artist and everybody needs to appreciate him. And she's totally down to write like a Pulp Fiction style script with her boyfriend. And you're rolling your eyes at this character the whole way through. And then after the relationship takes some sort of twists and turns, it's always kind of screwing with you a little bit about who the narrator is, how much you can trust the narrator. It opens with the narrator and then immediately kills off the narrator. It's very showy that way. It's all red pen magic and fireworks. It shifts radically and it moves all the action over to Spain. And it starts again with another story where you have Antonio Banderas as this oil grove magnate. A young woman played by Laia Costa, who I love a lot. If people saw the movie Victoria, it was the single-take action thriller from Germany. She is a person who deserves to be an American star, so I'm very happy to see her in this. And, you know, this movie, I guess, is about how love is magical, and it's all building toward a twist that you can kind of see, despite the fact that this tries to be like a giant maze and a scribble and a twisty path down a mountain road. I don't know, Justin, man, this movie.
Life itself.
The movie seems to be... have this radical thesis that if you show someone dying under horrible and shocking circumstances, the viewer will instantly just burst into tears. That's the desired effect. I was never in tears during this movie. I was very close to bursting out laughing many times. And this is one of those mosaic movies, like as Amy put it so well, it's sort of like Babel, Crash, but maybe even worse, where this idea that our lives are all interconnected and you don't believe these stories in of themselves. You certainly don't believe them when they're put into this narrative blender. I do think the movie gets a little bit better when it goes to Andalusia and when the Antonio Banderas, but the actors are so good that you feel sorry for them for being so good, because these characters and just this writing really does not deserve it.
Life Itself, written and directed by Dan Fogelman. Oscar Isaac, Olivia Wilde starts rated R in wide release. Colette is a British drama starring Keira Knightley and Dominic West, directed by Wash Westmoreland, who co-wrote the screenplay based on the true story of the author, of course, Colette, who ghostwrites a novel for her successful writer husband and then follows her fight for creative ownership of the work.
finally we have a success, and then you imply that I'm not the true author of it.
No, I didn't.
People love to talk. They praise it to your face, and then the moment you turn around, there's knives in your back. I understand the mentality here. You don't.
Well, I understand it well enough to write a book that's a toast to Paris.
Colette, Justin.
Yeah, if you can sort of get past the dissonance of seeing a distinctly French story set largely in Paris and in parts of Burgundy where Colette grew up, performed in English. This is a very much, it feels like a British drawing room comedy most of the time. This is a very good and very entertaining and involving movie with terrific performances by Keira Knightley and especially by Dominic West as her husband, Willie, who was this sort of impresario of the literary and publishing world who employed a lot of ghostwriters, his poor wife being one of them, and who became a success and a talent who very much eclipsed him several times over, but her early novels were published under his name. And so this movie is sort of an origin story for Sidonie Gabrielle Colette, or Colette as she was ultimately came to call herself, and showing her the early thriving of her talent within the boundaries of this very repressive but also very unorthodox marriage. And Dominic West is so good in the movie that I almost feel like it becomes a problem, because in a way it almost reorients the film away from its very much its feminist thrust, and it doesn't, the movie does not villainize him, and you see the ways in which she loved him and she had tenderness for him, and perhaps even while doing such horrible things like locking her in her study and forcing her to write until she produced her next book, which would become a runaway bestseller, and fueling his horrible habits with gambling and prostitutes, he's still kind of a charming guy. Aside from all that, he's still kind of a charming guy.
Amy?
Yeah, I totally agree with everything Justin is saying. And I think it is so much to the film's credit that it goes that way, because this could so easily just be Horrible Husband, the movie. And instead, you get, like, to me, the most interesting parts about it were just watching her still love him and find the little crannies in which they still fit together and were a strong couple for many, many, many years, even while he's having open affairs. She's also, you know, in love with a woman who's like kind of a gender nonconforming countess. I did like seeing this portrait of turn of the century Paris where people really were comfortable trying to break rules. It feels very fresh and modern and alive the way that they depict it. Even though, you know, when she wears a suit in public, her husband just, it's like she walked in wearing nothing but a giant ostrich feather. Actually, that's probably even worse. He'd probably be fine if she wore an ostrich feather. But yeah, Keira Knightley is just lovely, and I think she is one of our underrated actresses. I don't think this movie strains her as much as it could, but I think she's absolutely just charming.
Colette, the film, it's rated R, directed by Wash Westmoreland, Keira Knightley, and Dominic West star. You can see it at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. The documentary Science Fair follows nine high school students at the International Science and Engineering Fair. It's directed by Christina Costantini and Darren Foster. Amy.
Yeah, the International Science Fair is a gigantic, gigantic, huge deal. And the one that they're studying here actually took place in Los Angeles. There are 1,700 finalists from 78 countries all here. And if you got depressed watching the Michael Moore movie, at least you get a little cheerful watching these kids, because they're all trying to invent things that will save the planet. And if we give them any boost, if we lived in a country that maybe supported STEM even a little more, I would feel very relieved about where this country or where the world is heading. You know, it's you have people in there who are studying things like how does addiction work for high school kids, people trying to come up with new airplanes, people trying to, you know, who are from tiny, tiny rural villages in Brazil working on the Zika virus, coming to America for the first time. It's incredibly choppy. This is one of those spellbound sort of documentaries where it does not at all deviate from that structure. It's just like, here's a person, here's a person, here's a person, here's a person, here's one quirky fun fact about each one. This guy loves trap music. This guy is writing a program that can do Kanye West raps automatically. And I can't say I was ever that narratively involved in it, but there are some characters in there who this is their entire life. And they're almost kind of cocky and can turn off the audience a bit, but their commitment to it, you respect them. And so, yeah, I wouldn't say this is a very well-made film, but I would say it's a very good-feeling film. It's a vitamin type of film. I was happy it got made.
Science Fair, Rated PG, you can see it at the Arclight Sherman Oaks, Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills, and the Regal Cinemas at LA Live, probably close to where the science fair itself was conducted. It's rated PG. Hale County This Morning, This Evening, a documentary that takes a look at folks in rural Hale County, Alabama, over the course of 5 years. Justin?
I saw this documentary right after seeing Fahrenheit 11/9, and it was sort of a gorgeous palate cleanser. It's a beautifully photographed, impressionist documentary. It was shot, written, produced, edited, and sound recorded by the director, Ramel Ross. It spends several years in the lives of two African-American men and their families living in Hale County, Alabama. One of those men is a basketball player who's about to go off to college and hoping for a life outside of this small town. Another is a young man who dropped out of school to raise a family with his girlfriend. You can sort of make out glimpses of a narrative or a progression, but the movie is oriented in a very poetic and fragmented way. It was whittled down from 1,300 hours of footage into less than 80 minutes. And so it is spare, it is haunting, and it's quietly radical, like simply by dropping us into these images, which are focused largely on very quotidian activity, like a kid running around tracing the same arc over and over again, a young man shooting hoops on a basketball court, a bunch of guys hanging out in the locker room, or a woman giving birth, or people worshiping at a church service. The movie means to reclaim the depiction of African-American people on screen. He's using an experimental film language to do that. The movie opens with this quote that says that its goal is to sort of like figure out how we came to be seen. And the movie then attempts to provide an answer.
The film is Hale County This Morning, This Evening. Ramel Ross is the director of the documentary. It's unrated. It's at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, and Lemley's Playhouse, Pasadena. Assassination Nation, a thriller starring Odessa Young and Suki Waterhouse. It's written and directed by Sam Levinson. Amy?
Yeah, Assassination Nation was the biggest buy at this year's Sundance. They went all in on this film, which, having seen it the day before they purchased it, I was like, are you serious? What is happening? But what it is it's this midnight movie that is sort of very femme-powering, also not at all. It takes place in a modern-day Salem, and it stars sort of the mean girl clique of the crew, this very group of, like, sexy girls who wear socks that say things like fatal attraction. And what happens is everyone in this town has a secret, because all humans have secrets, and some mysterious force starts hacking into people's phones, and he starts by publishing some secret details about the mayor that get everybody in the town against him. Then he moves on to the male high school principal, which is actually how the Salem witchcraft trials even started. They started with attacking middle-aged men and then went to the teen girls. So it's mirroring that in a way. And it's a lot about the hypocrisy. Like when these grown men are attacked for what's on their phone, the girls are very unsympathetic, like they should have known better. But then as the film progresses and then everybody becomes a target, it turns into this all men against teenage girls movie. And then these girls who are kind of horrible people also become these eventual heroines who like fight for their life and beat up everybody. And it's cathartic nonsense and it means really nothing. I think this is designed to try to get teenage girls hooping in the theaters, which, God bless them, I love that idea. But the film itself, when you put it on under a spotlight at all, makes zero sense.
Assassination Nation from writer-director Sam Levinson. It's rated R. It's in select theaters. And finally, the documentary Jane Fonda in 5 Acts. Susan Lacey, the director. Justin?
This is a moving and very well-constructed portrait of Jane Fonda with an interesting structural conceit. Each of the first 4 acts of this movie is devoted to one of the men in her life, starting, of course, with her father, Henry Fonda, and continuing on with her husbands, Roger Vadim, Tom Hayden, and Ted Turner. It's interesting when you hear that because it might seem odd to structure a story about a feminist and activist icon around the men in her life, but the deeper insight of the movie, which Jane Fonda points out in her interviews here, is that each of these relationships shaped and formed her indelibly, and that each relationship has been sort of a struggle to figure out, this constant push-pull of figuring out her identity. It's a long film. It's 2 hours and 15 minutes, but it feels less long when you learn it was edited down from like 21 hours of interviews, and it will lend itself very well to play on HBO, where it's starting this Monday.
Documentary Jane Fonda in 5 Acts, Susan Lacey, the director of the film. It's unrated. Coming up on Film Week, we're going to turn our attention to those who've made accusations against people in Hollywood as part of the whole Me Too movement. How have their lives changed? changed as a result of that? What's been the effect on their careers after they came public and made the accusations that they did? We're going to talk with the Rap's Sharon Waxman, the founder and editor of the online entertainment publication. We'll hear about those interviews coming up. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by film critics Amy Nicholson and Justin Chang. And for the balance of the program, very pleased to be joined by the founder and editor of the online entertainment media site, The Rap, Sharon Waxman. Sharon, it's good to have you with us again. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Larry.
So you've had a series that has been playing over the past several days in which you go back to those who've made accusations against people in Hollywood, accusations of sexual misconduct, because so much focus has been on what's happened to those who've been accused. You turn it around and look at what the impact has been on those who've made the allegations. How many folks have you talked with over the course of preparing this?
Yeah, it's been about a three-month project, and we spoke to 12 women and men who accused prominent people in the Hollywood ecosystem. And we wanted to we took it exactly from the perspective that you just raised, which is there's been so much focus on what happened to the men who were accused. They've lost their jobs. There's a lot of discussion about when do they come back? How do they come back? And we actually started with, okay, it's going to be a year pretty soon. Let's see what's happened to the men. And in the course of that conversation, we kind of ended up flipping it around and said, wait a minute, what about the women? And because I think that most of us would presume that the women who got to tell their stories finally got to unburden themselves, had this great moment of catharsis, and then took a breath in and breath out and went on with their lives. In fact, when you start talking to them, you find that that's not at all the case. And for most of the women, it's been an extremely traumatic year or however many months since they came forward and told their stories. And it's kind of all over the map in terms of how it's impacted them, because, you know, first there's the whole sort of therapeutic piece, which is, you know, they've unearthed these really deep emotions and very traumatic experiences that they'd buried for quite a long time in many cases. And so there's like re-traumatized in a way. So we talk in the series, we also talked to some psychologists. We've talked to some kind of sociologists about what that's about. But just hearing from them themselves, it was fascinating and really unexpected.
One of the things that I was very surprised by, I guess in my mind, I anticipated that the people close to the individuals making the accusations, their friends, their family members, kind of rally around them. And sometimes that happened, but as is detailed in these conversations, that didn't always happen. There's some people who felt like they were really socially isolated, even by people they would have expected to stand by them.
Right. So you have everything from a woman like Lauren Sivan, who was famously the person, I hope I'm allowed to say this because this is what she said.
Be cautious because we're on the radio.
I'll be cautious. We're on the radio. She was confronted by Harvey Weinstein at a party, and he did something into a plant to satisfy himself or pleasured himself. Can I say that?
Yeah, you can say
into
that.
Plant, yeah. And it was so shocking. She was an on-air reporter for Fox, local Fox TV, and they just stopped hiring her after that. So she wasn't exactly fired, but she had actually tried to bring the story to her bosses to say, let me break my own Me Too story. They didn't want her to do it. She ended up telling her story to the Huffington Post.
It was after the original Ronan Farrow piece.
Exactly. After the first Ronan Farrow story broke, and it was that first weekend, and it was just like, pow, like a big explosion had gone off. And she's lost her ability to do the profession that she loved. It's not like she can't work elsewhere, but she's working a lot less. And then there's other – was one woman who's looking to change her name because she's so associated now with her rape allegation or her sexual assault allegation that that's all that comes up about her online. Because remember, a lot of these women, and there is a few men as well, were fairly obscure.
Yeah, so it's not like they're not public figures.
Right, they're not public figures. So when the people start writing about them and that's all you become associated with online, and they're mothers. They have kids. They have jobs. One's a teacher. So this one wants to change her name.
And to me, I guess I would have thought that the accusers in this position this would have been part of what factored into making it so difficult to come forward, because you know if you do that, it's like potentially forevermore, but at least for the next couple of years, when people hear your name, the first thing that's going to come to mind, if they're not close in your life and know you otherwise, is right. The accusation.
That's right. Right. By the way, I should mention that most of the series was written by Itai Hodd, who's one of our who's our lead investigative reporter. I want to make sure he gets a shout out because he's been building the relationships, as have I, over the past year with these women. And because it's a lot of trust for them to come forward and say, look, it's not been all sort of glory. We don't necessarily love the attention. And I'm not saying that the women are saying, I wish I hadn't done it. That's not the case. And of course, I don't want to paint everybody with the same brush. They're all individuals and they have individual responses to how in some cases they're very glad that they came forward, and whatever the side effects have been worth it for them. But anyway, I just wanted to say that it's been a process. And then we've had women who came to us and then they want to take the interviews back. It's not always an easy process for them to decide what they want to share at this point, because they feel like they feel very vulnerable still.
And the gender and sexuality dynamics even interesting, because you have a man who made an accusation against a noted fashion photographer,
Bruce Weber,
who is a straight man. And so then the whole sexuality issue comes into play. Being that he's straight, not a gay man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the men, I think, in these instances have in some ways, it feels like they have an even tougher time, because it calls into question their manhood and their virility. And it doesn't actually, but I could see how it would feel that way to them. And this whole idea of like men being that vulnerable, I do think it's really brave of those who came forward. And I salute all of them, honestly. It's not easy. Just look at Christine Blasey Ford today, who apparently, and not reporting on this, just reading the news reports, she's in hiding. She can't live in her house. She's under death threat because she dared to come forward and level an accusation against a Supreme Court nominee. It's not easy.
We're talking with Sharon Waxman, the founder and editor of The Wrap, the online entertainment and media site. And I welcome your call. If you're someone who is in the entertainment community and you've made an accusation, maybe it's not a high profile one that's been part of the Me Too, because, of course, accusations were made previously in years past as well. I'd be curious in hearing your personal experience, what that was like for you, what the benefits that you experienced and any potential downside professionally or personally as well in telling your story. 866-893-KPCC. This is for those listening live on our Friday Film Week broadcast, 866-893-5722. We've also got our Film Week page that you can find under Air Talk, and you can also post a comment there. And we have on our Air Talk Film Week pages a link to the series that The Wrap has as well. So you can read episode by episode as it details the interviews with the Hollywood figures. Sharon, do you have any sense as to whether, and I know this has just come out, this might have a chilling effect on people sharing their stories, because maybe it makes it more real what the double-edged sword is here in going public?
Well, if there's a chilling effect, I have to think it has a lot to do with the fact that there's a feeling in the Me Too movement, and I'm not a spokesperson for the Me Too movement. I'm just reflecting the conversations that I've had with individual women. And there's been splintering within the Me Too movement. There's been some it started out, I think, with a lot of solidarity and compassion and a sense of connection. And then kind of inevitably, as these things go on, there's rivalries and disagreements, and there's some tension between the Me Too and the Time's Up movement. There are some who feel that companies that might have been complicit in their being placed in a position as women to be attacked, whether it's an agency or whether it's a PR company, that were complicit with Harvey Weinstein, are now trying to somehow repent in a way by supporting Time's Up, and they don't want to have anything to do with that. So, and then we have this whole muddying of the waters with the whole Asia Argento, and did she prey upon a young man? So, it's I think all of that makes it difficult.
We'll continue our conversation with The Wrap's Sharon Waxman. Also hear from our critics Amy Nicholson and Justin Chang as they weigh in on the personal stories of those who've made accusations against people in Hollywood, what the effect has been on their careers as well as on their personal life. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're doing great. Joined by critics Justin Chang and Amy Nicholson. Also with us from The Wrap, the founder and editor of the online publication, Sharon Waxman. We're talking about a multi-part series that's run over the course of this week, focusing on those who've made allegations of sexual misconduct in Hollywood and how their lives have changed in the months since they made those accusations. Now, related to the Me Too movement and the role of power in Hollywood and gender, there's an upcoming event that The Wrap is hosting, the Power Women's Summit, in early November. Sharon, share with us some of the people that you're bringing together for the event.
Right. So that event has flown directly from our reporting around the Me Too allegations and our own series that we've been doing for years now around women's leadership to bring women from media and entertainment together. So just to give you a little bit of the background, last October we had something called the Power Women Breakfast because all we had done was breakfast. The whole idea is like, women are busy. We're going to take an hour to talk about leadership. And it happened like 3 weeks after all of this broke. So we threw out the whole program and invited all these Me Too survivors. About 15 of them came, including one from New Zealand, Zoe Brock, and they met for the first time at that breakfast. So as that, what flowed from there was our decision to bring everyone together, as many women as we could, from media and entertainment for this summit, which is going to be 1,000 women, November 1st and 2nd. We have every major media and entertainment company, for the most part, participating. I can tell you now that we just got confirmed that Anita Hill is going to be joining us. We have speakers from Sherry Lansing, the first woman to head a studio, the founders of Time's Up, Tina Chen and Robbie Kaplan, former Senator Barbara Boxer, the legendary political activist Dolores Huerta, showrunner Jill Soloway, the actress Felicity Jones talking about playing Ruth Bader Ginsburg in this in an upcoming movie this fall, the founder of Me Too, Tarana Burke and Mira Sorvino, and women from young girls from the March for Our Lives movement will be receiving will be honored there. That's just a sense, a taste of how this is shaping up to be a really historic event.
We have a link on our AirTalk Film Week page if people are interested in additional information about the Power Women's Summit, November 1st, 2nd, Intercontinental Hotel, downtown L.A. Again, all the information is there. It's sponsored by The Wrap. Sharon Waxman, the founder, editor of The Wrap, joining us. Amy, your thoughts is about, you know, reading these accounts of the accuser. Any surprises for you?
I was still very surprised, and I guess there's a part of me that's surprised. I'm still capable of being surprised to hear how hard the last year has been for them. When you recounted the story of the news anchor here on the radio, and when I read about it, I was just shocked. I can't believe that in a year I feel like we've done nothing but talk, and you have such an amazing powerhouse of women leading this movement who you're bringing to your day, that it's still just like beating our heads against the wall for these stories to get heard. I mean, bringing up Christine Ford, which you did, that even this week, people still think that women would just bring up their stories to be famous when the evidence is so overwhelmingly the exact opposite of that. I don't know how that message gets through to people that are just, I guess, refusing to hear it.
Well, change isn't easy, I think, is probably the answer. And people are more comfortable the way things are. And so if we're going to drive some change, I mean, I'm a big believer in the impact that Hollywood has on our society at large and our society around the world. It's really the reason why, having been a foreign correspondent in the first part of my career, I could really see that impact when I lived abroad in the Middle East and in Europe, and feel really like it's worth it to spend our time to have a healthier entertainment industry. Because if we can get gender equity, because that's the theme of the summit, 50-50 by 2020, 50-50 gender balance behind the camera, in the director's seat, in the boardrooms, in the executive suites, and everyone likes to say, oh, it's not possible, it's ridiculous, why are you even trying to talk about a goal that's unachievable? I think if we don't set ambitious goals and if we don't hold ourselves to a standard, even if it is not achievable, then we don't get anywhere. And that is what this whole gathering is about, is practically speaking, how do we get to 50-50 gender equity? Because I don't think that we have to try so hard to count women to men in any given production. If we have women in areas of leadership, then I think it just flows out. And if our storytellers, I'll finish one second, and we have a lot of breakouts of women telling our stories, if the women if there's balance in the women telling our stories, then that ripples through everywhere in our society.
One of the things that I think would be helpful in this process is to having even more information about what the barriers are. I mean, there's certain things we assume are barriers to it, gender assumptions about women versus men that come into play, reluctance of people who are in positions of control to cede any of that control. But getting a better handle on the complexity of what those barriers are, where they assert themselves. Is it, you know, someone comes out of film school, is it like right away that they sort of get tripped up in accomplishing, or is it something that comes down the road? And I wonder if there are ways of getting more information about this as a way of understanding then how you tackle those barriers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are there's lots of processes now. You know, Women in Film has a whole workshop called Reframe. We're going to be doing one at the summit, but they're working with all the studios to work toward having just exactly what you're talking about, practical advice. And I think that I know that, for example, at NBC Universal, there's a really big effort around giving women tools. There's something, it's almost like a bringing women back at a certain age. There's a whole conversation about women after a certain age and how they age out. And so how you get those women considered for jobs. Maybe it's part-time. They have a tremendous amount of expertise, but then as the industry changes, they don't have...
Or women that have kids. And,
totally.
You know,
totally.
Again, because we still have a gender division on how many men leave the workforce to care for children versus women. And obviously daycare is a big part of that, a lot of complex issues. But
and I think it's also hard because so many men want to be part of the solution. And one of the things that we're doing is we're inviting men to come in during the lunch period to sort of network and talk and show their support, because nobody gets anywhere without everybody working together to make it happen. And this whole, I mean, I've encountered so much in my conversations in Hollywood of men feeling defensive and just feeling like they're accused without even being accused. They're afraid to pat a colleague on the back.
Well, we hear this all the time in phone calls from listeners who work in the industry, men who feel like, I'm not quite sure how to relate to women in the workplace.
Exactly.
Now.
And so I think that again, it's a process. It's not, there's not a black or white, like most men have good intentions and they know how to behave. There's been a number of bad apples and a lot of them are gone.
Sharon Waxman, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Larry.
Founding editor of The Wrap, the online entertainment media site, Sharon Waxman with us. And my thanks to our terrific critics, as always, Amy Nicholson. You can read her writing on film in The Guardian and listen to her on the podcast. She hosts The Canon and Unspooled. Justin Chang, you read his film criticism in the Los Angeles Times. Have a wonderful weekend from all of us. We remind you that Film Week comes your way every Friday and Saturday, right here on 89.3 KPCC.